The conference, I assume, was planned for this date to coincide with the 50th anniversary. So 50 years ago yesterday, Lyndon Johnson, in his State of the Union address, declared this unconditional war on poverty. And I'm sure somewhere among all the bicycles here, there was an undergraduate couple that declared their unconditional love for one another. And poverty, like young love, at some point comes to the realization that it's complicated and that there are many conditions on that. And so what I want to talk about today are some of the early conditions that complicated Lyndon Johnson's unconditional approach to poverty. And as I think we know, there were quite a few conditions, both in terms of what poverty was, but also in the politics of the day, and also in just what kind of time one person as president has to deal with this issue of poverty that we always will have with us, according to the Bible, at least I think it's in the Bible. The photograph that's up here on the top, and I'll come back to this, is maybe my single favorite photograph explaining the economics of the Kennedy and Johnson administration. You can probably figure out which one is John Kennedy. He was assassinated. And by the way, there were far more stories on his assassination than there were on the Declaration of a War on Poverty. To his right is Lyndon Johnson, who is looking off camera. But then right in between the two is a gentleman named Walter Heller. Walter Heller probably needs no introduction to most of the people in the room. He was the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers from 1961 until 1964. And it's his vision, so literally he's looking through his glasses, so it's his vision that's going to connect the Johnson and Kennedy administrations. And it's that vision that's going to look right down the middle of the Great Society, right down the middle of the war on poverty. And it will be his relationship, particularly with the gentleman on the right, Lyndon Johnson, that turns a series of theories and a series of aspirations and a series of dreams into programs that will do things for people on the ground and will cause people to debate what exactly they did for many years after that. The politics of the period are a pretty complicated set of politics. I'm going to do what historians hate to do, and I'm going to oversimplify them. But we do it quite often, and I think it's actually part of our job. So the politics of the 1960s, which we started out with, are complicated. That's a good political word for saying there's not enough time to really explain this to all the people that haven't really looked at this at such a deep level. But I haven't looked at it that deeply. I'll go ahead and say in terms of economics, I'm not an economic historian, so I'm pretending most of what I'm talking about up here today. But in the big, broad sense, the 1960s are a situation which I would characterize as the politics of potential, where the people that are going to win are the ones that are going to be able to sell that potential, that they can cause the United States to make up the gaps that existed. Now, a couple of those gaps, so if we've got the 1960s as a series of gaps, if you go back to Gunnar Myrdal's characterization in the 1940s of this big gap between the ideal America and its values and the real America, particularly talking about Jim Crow and racial segregation, that's a big gap that's there in the 1960s. There was something that helped John Kennedy defeat Richard Nixon in 1960, this thing called the missile gap. It was a lie. There was a huge gap, but it was the United States having a vast number of nuclear warheads compared to the small number that the Soviets had. But nevertheless, the politics of potential and saying, there's a gap here, we have to make it up. Walter Heller, who I'll be focusing on today, had what I'll call the Heller Gap. And I think this is at the heart of the Great Society and the war on poverty. Walter Heller was famous for being able to explain economic issues in terms that just about anybody could understand. And he talked about the gap between where we are and where we could be. And he's talking specifically about where we, as a historian, I've left off the last part of that sentence because it didn't work as well. But the reality is what he says is where we could be with full employment. And so what Walter Heller is pushing for is for an economy that is based upon full employment, which was about 3% unemployment, but nevertheless, that's another issue that we can discuss at the break. Now, Lyndon Johnson would become, in 1963, in 1964, in 1965, the master of the politics of potential. He's been called the master of the Senate, the architect of American ambition, the flawed giant, the rising star. Everybody has a metaphor for Lyndon Johnson, so I'm going to throw in my own metaphor here. He's the master of the politics of potential. And if you think about the idea of potential, Lyndon Johnson's tapping into something here that is not unique to him, but is something that is clear to Americans, and it's clear to how he's projecting himself as a cowboy president. You know, his idea of America is a frontier America, where there's always something else out there. John Kennedy had articulated this as a new frontier. And so what Johnson's doing is building upon this idea that there's a gap between what we are and what we could become. And Lyndon Johnson's going to anchor his early presidency on that. Now, what did Lyndon Johnson want to do? He had a very small ambition. Lyndon Johnson wanted to do three things. Well, he wanted to do a lot more than that, but I'm going to break it down to three things. He wanted, and it's not hard to figure out how to do it. He wanted to end poverty. He wanted to end racism. And he wanted to end unemployment. So he comes into office after the assassination of John Kennedy in the time of this Cold War. And he's got these three pretty simple tasks that he's going to lay out ahead of him. Needless to say, Lyndon Johnson was a dreamer. And he didn't dream small. He dreamed in Texas colors, dreamed in Texas-sized increments. And he wanted to end poverty and end racism and end unemployment. He didn't think he could do it tomorrow, but he thought he could set up a structure that would lead to it. And the economists in his White House projected that maybe by 1966 they would be at this full employment figure and that everything would be great in the United States. Now, Johnson would articulate his specific vision, the Great Society vision, in a speech in May of 1964 at the University of Michigan. It's his famous Great Society speech. And one of the key things that comes out of that is his emphasis on wealth and how wealth was not just simply about money. Wealth was not just simply about people creating more wealth. He didn't want to create what he referred to as soulless wealth. He wanted to create a society where the city of man dealt with the needs of the body and of commerce, but also for the hunger for beauty and community. So this is an American president that is talking about hunger for beauty and community, and he's wrapping it up to say, this wealth that we're generating, the economy's growing at about 5% a year, this needs to do more than just make more money. It's got to do a lot more. And what he really wanted it to do was wrap it into the civil rights struggle, wrap it into this big vision of closing many of these gaps, to turn America into this great society. It couldn't just be a good society. It had to become that great society. Now, one of the key issues, how do you do this? Lyndon Johnson didn't think this was a problem. You simply think about it. You get smart people around you. You have all of these Harvards, that he called them, from the Kennedy administration that were there giving him lots of ideas. And they helped him. And Johnson's going to try to structure this vision of growth. And this growth would be the magic beanstalk that would grow and grow and grow, and it wouldn't just lead up to heaven. It would spread out and take everybody up with it. You know, the common phrases, rising tide lifts all boats. Johnson's favorite phrase was he wanted to turn tax eaters into taxpayers. So this was about getting everybody into the mix. This was about getting individuals to contribute. Not a government top-down engineered solution, but turning individual people into better consumers, into better citizens, into better voters, so that they could make these choices, and it would be that competition that would lead to the growth that would come about later. Now, this gentleman, Walter Heller, is going to be a critical person in this mix. And I've got a couple of photographs here to show you of Walter Heller. This is Walter Heller. His parents were German immigrants, hence the middle name Wolfgang. I don't know how many economists there are with Wolfgang in their name, but if I'm sure somebody in here knows a Wolfgang. If not, but this is Walter Heller. You can't see it very well here. He's holding in his arms what is almost literally his baby. This is the economic report of the president from 1962. And it is this report that lays out the vision of growth, that lays out the call for the politics that would lead to the big tax cut. It would be this document here that would structure. You know, when Heller in 1961 is staring between the shoulders of Johnson and Kennedy, he's got this book in his head, and it hasn't quite been written exactly yet, but he puts it out there. And so this, I think, is a really good photograph of Walter Heller. And what Walter Heller is going to have to do is compete for space with all of those Harvards, with all of those Princetonians, all of those pinstripe folks that Lyndon Johnson secretly loathed, or maybe not so secretly loathed, but needed and respected many of them. Heller was not a Harvard. He was a Midwestern guy. He was currently on leave from the University of Minnesota. And when Lyndon Johnson took office, Walter Heller wanted to get out of town. He was $16,000 in debt. Adjusted for inflation, I think it's about $150,000 in debt in those 3 years. To adjust for the cost of living in Washington, D.C. compared to Minnesota, he had three children. He had a wife who had suffered from lupus. He'd actually already had his family move back to Minnesota. So he was on his way out. Lyndon Johnson, who refused to sit back and not get what he wanted, put the pressure on Heller to stick around, which he did until November of 1964. So he was there to provide that stare for Lyndon Johnson. Now, if you go and look at some of the photographs of Heller and the LBJ Library and the JFK Library, they have photograph collections of all the stuff taken at the White House. I thought we could play a little game here, and I don't know game theory. That was LBJ saying, stop making fun of me. This is a little game of Where's Walter? Where's Walter Heller? Which comes off of the Where's Waldo books. And if you know Waldo wears these red and white striped things, well, this is Walter Heller over here. This is a cabinet meeting in the Kennedy administration. And so you have all of the big egos sitting at the table, Interior, Treasury, State, Attorney General, LBJ, directly across from the President. And there's Walter Heller sitting in his traditional position right behind, but if you notice, he's right behind Kennedy, right? It's that stare coming right behind Kennedy. So this is Heller blown up, so we can give him more of his due in history. This is another photograph. We're trying to identify where's Walter. And one of the things I found is looking at these photographs is Walter Heller sometimes doesn't look like Walter Heller. You know, he has one of these faces that, you know, it's not like JFK's where, okay, that's JFK. Or, you know, folks, these glasses and the hair, and depending on the light, this is Walter Heller behind the Prime Minister of Britain, Harold Macmillan. There on the Honey Fitz, which was the presidential yacht. And there is Heller in the background. So all of these photographs, if you're going to caption them, they're Walter Heller in the background. Another one, this is the signing in ceremony that I talked about at the beginning. And this is Walter Heller here. These are the assistant secretaries and some of the key appointees in the Kennedy administrations just after the inauguration. Jackie has shown up. LBJ has shown up. Lady Bird supposedly is there. She's standing behind President Kennedy, so you can see her hand here. This is Deputy Secretary of Defense. This is Byron Wizard White, who was in the Justice Department, soon to be up to the Supreme Court. And then there's Walter Heller here, and what's the word, in the background. And this is Heller blown up. Making that stare. He's essentially the bullseye in this moment. To give you a little context of how important the Council of Economic Advisors were, this is Gardner Ackley's swearing-in ceremony in 1962. Again, Walter Heller in the background. The person swearing him in, reading off a piece of paper, is the Assistant Executive Clerk to the White House. It's not John Kennedy, and in that other one, it was the Supreme Court Chief Justice that was administering the oaths of office. In this case, they get the room. It was just their office with the exposed plumbing, dug into the wall. reading off a sheet of paper. And then we get to the Johnson White House. Where's Walter? Well, Walter is over here by the flag behind the president, staring over. And this is him, staring at Lyndon Johnson. And I do want you to get this sense here of Lyndon Johnson leaning in. Because I'll talk about one of the metaphors that Walter Heller had about the economy. He didn't want presidents who merely leaned in against the wind or leaned out against the wind to try to shave off these business cycles. He wanted a president that wouldn't be preoccupied with every little wiggle of the economy. He wanted a president that would look to the future and create a prolonged, long-term growth and would use fiscal policy to do that. And so Lyndon Johnson here is leaning in, and if you know Johnson, I'm sure he was wiggling in his seat. Now, Walter Heller had in his bag of tricks the ability to talk to presidents and the ability to go on television and talk to the American people. And so Walter Heller would be recruited by Lyndon Johnson, and certainly before that by the Kennedy administration, to go and put forward this vision of the economy to the American people. And so after the assassination, he becomes a point person for the Johnson administration to go out and explain why this tax cut was necessary. And what I want to do is boil down Johnson's economic vision to a formula. I will go ahead and say that I'm not very good at math, and I'm in a room full of brilliant economic minds. My children love the idea that I failed geometry in high school. So I'm going to put together what I think is a pretty simple formula for Johnson's economic vision in early 1964, late 1963. And that was $100 billion minus $11 billion equals $1 billion. It's the new math, right? And by the way, there is a new math and it doesn't make sense and your kids will have to explain it to you. That $100 billion is the budget. John Kennedy had already put forward a budget that was over $100 billion. Lyndon Johnson, to get that $11 billion tax cut, needed to buy off the interest of several politicians, but particularly an arch-segregationist, white supremacist senator from Virginia named Harry Byrd, who was the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, who could bottle up the tax bill and never let it out without a lot of effort. So Johnson needed Harry Byrd. Harry Byrd was not going to agree to stand down in his opposition to that $11 billion tax cut until he got concessions on expenditures. And so what Lyndon Johnson did was set this symbolic threshold of $100 billion to keep that budget under $100 billion. This irritated liberals. This irritated Walter Heller. It actually irritated LBJ. He wanted a much bigger budget, but he saw the politics of the situation. And so what I'll talk about later is part of that process of getting that $100-plus billion down to the upper 90s. And Lyndon Johnson would do that with the novel concept of cutting defense expenditures and shifting that money over to fight a war on poverty. So to get that $1 billion of the initial appropriation for the war on poverty, he was cutting funding for bases, for missiles, for other things. And so he's leaning on Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara to squeeze out some money, and he's also squeezing out money throughout the budget. But he's making these open appeals. We got enough defense stuff. Let's cut out some of the waste and turn it into things for people, or in Johnson's argument, for grandma. The $11 billion part of this, which I'll talk about later, is the political struggle to get the Senate to agree to this tax cut. And so Lyndon Johnson had these big visions, he had these big dreams, but it had to be accomplished in small rooms and on the telephone and in putting pressure in the right place at the right time. And so at the end of today's talk, what I will look at is Johnson's effort to turn the tide and turn the opinions of a couple of key senators to support the tax bill and to keep it from being knocked off the rails. So if I can summarize where we are right at this point of how Lyndon Johnson's going to go from the post-assassination period to declaring a war on poverty, to declaring this great society, to actually building the great society through legislation. Here is the formula again, $100 billion minus 11 equals $1 billion. So what Johnson needed to do to make this happen was first he needed to get this budget down under $100 billion, which I'll go ahead and say Walter Heller called a charade, and he said it was just a symbolic gesture, that the administrative budget from the White House is essentially a figment of the imagination. It's not a bank account. It is not real money. It is a political document to create an argument for a certain vision. And so if the vision was we need this to get it, our bigger vision passed, then so be it. And so the liberals that were opposed to some of the cuts to the budget eventually stood down to make it possible to happen. So you have to get this budget passed. So you think about Lyndon Johnson and all the calculations that are going into this. Get the budget passed, to get the tax cut passed. And for Johnson, the tax cut meant everything else could become possible. Without continued economic growth, and pretty dramatic economic growth in an election year, then this great vision of the great society and of an unconditional war on poverty would just be a series of ideas. You needed the economy to grow. If you're going to have a rising tide to lift those boats, that tide has to keep rising. And so he's created a political calculation here that often defies logic. So keep the budget under $100 million. You cut $11 billion from that budget, hopefully to stimulate the economy where you're going to get more money coming into the budget later. And if you make that possible, then you build the political room to get the Civil Rights Act passed. And in terms of the Civil Rights Act and Lyndon Johnson, you cannot separate it from the war on poverty. You can't separate it from the larger vision of economic growth. Professor Gavin Wright here has a new book that looks at the economic impact of the civil rights movement and what was happening. And I think Lyndon Johnson was someone that saw civil rights reforms as essential to the economy. And the Council of Economic Advisers saw racial reform as essential to economic growth. There was a calculation that if African Americans participated in the American economy and had the same educational levels as other Americans, that there would be an additional $22 billion produced each year. So the growth potential, that idea of potential and gap, was enormous. If you could get rid of this Jim Crow system where people could actually buy a hamburger, even though Ella Baker said it was about more than a hamburger, being able to buy that hamburger was a pretty important component. Then lifting these job discrimination issues, having African Americans be able to actually participate as full first-class citizens, as economic participants and consumers. This is essential to the Johnson vision, and it's essential to the Council of Economic Advisers' vision of both the war on poverty and the larger issues of economic growth. So the Civil Rights Act, so you get the budget to get the tax cut, and politically speaking, Lyndon Johnson could see the writing on the wall, and everybody, not just Lyndon Johnson, everybody knew that Southern senators were going to filibuster the Civil Rights Bill. They had done it for a very long time. Lyndon Johnson had been part of breaking those filibusters in the past. And so he knew that if this tax bill did not get passed very quickly, that once that Civil Rights Bill made its way through the House and then onto the Senate, it was going to gum up everything in Washington, D.C. Just like the traffic in Washington, D.C. now gets gummed up, it's just like the tax cut and the Civil Rights Bill were a big accident sitting on the interstate in the Beltway, and nothing was going to happen if these bills got entangled. So Johnson had to get the tax cut bill through because of a variety of things, but he really wanted to get the support of corporate leaders. He spent hours on the phone, hours in person, reaching out to the heads of AT&T, the heads of some of the major corporations in the country, bringing them to the White House, literally holding their hand, showing them what a great thing this tax cut would be. And he's going to make an argument later which I'll talk about, to Richard Russell, saying that your Southern strategy on civil rights is getting messed up. If we don't get this tax bill through, you're going to have all these businessmen in your civil rights business. They're going to be pushing for this civil rights bill. So Johnson wants the tax bill pushed through. So when the civil rights bill gums things up on Capitol Hill, the tax cut is generating that growth in the economy. Johnson believed that it would lead to $30 million a day in additional growth to the economy. Then, if you get the Civil Rights Act, then you have in the machinery this war on poverty. So the Civil Rights Act signed in July of 1964, the War on Poverty, or the bill, the Economic Opportunity Act, signed in August of 1964. It's the big prize for Johnson. I mean, the Civil Rights is a big prize too, but you know there are lots of Kennedy hands on the Civil Rights Act. And in private, Johnson completely says to all the Southerners, this is a Kennedy bill. You know, I'm not in the NAACP. It's Barry Goldwater that was a member of the NAACP. You know, don't look at me. You know, I was just in office. I don't know what was happening with that Civil Rights Bill. You know, so Johnson could sell himself in different ways. So this war on poverty, though, was a much more Johnson thing. And it goes back to Walter Heller, just after the assassination, coming into the White House and sitting down with Johnson in his notepad and saying, here's what's going on. And he mentioned that Kennedy had committed himself to some kind of poverty thing once the new year rolled around. Johnson seized on that, as the popular narrative goes, and as Walter Heller tells it, says, that's my kind of program. I don't know where I'll find the money for it, but I'll find the money for it, and we're going to fund it. Heller shows up with the director of the budget to the LBJ Ranch after Christmas. They are the subject of harassment, of fun being poked at them by a bunch of ranchers and cowboy friends that Johnson had at the ranch, because they're wearing suits and the cowboy people are not wearing suits. And also there's this issue about beef imports, and so they, you know, say, well, how can you tell us what we need to do about beef imports when you don't even know what a cow looks like, except when you finally come down to the ranch? So they're there, but they get put off in a little building by themselves and smoke lots of cigarettes. And in their oral histories, they talk about the mounds of cigarette butts that they produced. And by the way, in January, the Surgeon General made his first declaration that cigarette smoking was bad for your health. And you know that starts off another narrative. But anyway, they're down at the ranch, and they develop a very broad-scale, ambitious war on poverty that will eventually make its way into a task force, and then under the hands of Sergeant Shriver, it will go through Congress and eventually come out as the War on Poverty Bill. So you get a budget cut, you get a tax cut, you get a civil rights bill, and that's a dramatic story, which is for another day. Then you get this War on Poverty Bill. And so Johnson is set up beautifully for what I think maybe his biggest thing is a big victory in the fall of 1964. He wanted a huge victory. He's got the Kennedy assassination that's going to almost certainly guarantee a victory, but he wanted big coattails, and particularly he wanted to have a lot of liberals elected on his coattails, and that is what's happened. And so as you put all these things together, you get the big election, which leads to the rest of the Great Society, which leads to a congressional coalition that can make it possible to pass something like Medicare and Medicaid, to pass other big-ticket items that will eventually restructure what kind of America existed. Now, the battles that are going to be led in Washington, and here, hopefully I won't mess things up too much. I do, since we're talking about LBJ, I wanted to bring him back from the dead. And let me, hopefully I can do this. Okay. This is, let me start here with LBJ explaining his vision in a way that I can't do it. But he does it very well. Now, if you're familiar with LBJ in his speeches and in his press conferences, he was really pretty dull. He would slick his hair back. He would put on those black rim glasses. And he liked to he taught speech in high school, so he liked to stand at the lectern as, you know, a speech teacher would want someone to stand at the lectern. He thought that was statesmanlike. It also didn't project as well on camera. But this is how Lyndon Johnson could describe things in private. The big context here is that Hubert Humphrey had given some remarks to the press that Johnson liked. I won't, for the sake of time, won't go through all this, but you can check these out online. He's talking about the Republican criticism of the Democratic Party. He says they could just come out and talk about the revival of the corn tassel or Tom Watson watermelons. That would be something, right? So they're not coming out with anything. He's not scared of anybody because nobody's saying what they're for. But this is what Lyndon Johnson, and I think if you want to narrow down Johnson's vision to a couple sentences, it's political, it's superficial, but nevertheless, I think it incorporates a big vision here. This is Johnson saying, this is what I stand for.
But we're the only ones that stand for anything. They're just against things. Yes, sir. Say, now, damn it, boys, you get here and get your speech and ask some questions here and get your name in the paper here, and every damn one of them, I'll take your line. What we are, we're for war on poverty. We're for economic growth. We're for world peace. We're for security. We're for Medicare. We're for human dignity. We're for human rights. Now, this is what we stand for, a government of strength, a government that's solvent, and a government that's compassionate. And it just makes these guys look silly.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I just want to congratulate you. I was reading it. It's the best thing I've seen all day. God damn it, I had Indonesia, and I had Panama, and I had Cyprus, and they're coming in tonight.
So for the last at least 13 years, I've been editing these conversations, and this is not an official script, but it's Johnson laying things out, but he's always going to come back and whine about something. And he had to stay up and make these decisions about foreign aid and whether he should give $60 million to India or not, and so he's going to head, we would call it humble bragging today online. Johnson was a great humble bragger, and I've often wondered what he would do with an iPhone. You would want to be on his list, but then you wouldn't want to be on his list. Imagine the LBJ Facebook page. Now, he is going to, if we can step back from that vision, to a couple weeks after the assassination, this is where Walter Heller comes in. Heller is making the circuit, selling the economic vision for the new administration. And Johnson's going to lay out here this politics of potential, or in the title of today's paper, I'm for Grandma, which in the exact translation says he's for Grandma. But anyway, this is him laying out the argument that Heller really needs to hammer, that we're going to cut defense expenditures, we're going to cut waste, and do something for people. We're going to be FDR. We're going to do that New Deal thing. And so this is a quick little snippet of Johnson and Heller.
He's been functioning since the day it was first announced. He participated in the formulation of the bill. He sat in on all the meetings, and he's made speeches all over the country about it, perhaps more than anybody in the administration. He's no Johnny come lately to it. Now, why is he cutting these expenses? He's cutting the waste and the things that he need not to, in order he has some money to do the things that he does need to do, and
right.
He may take out an antiquated installation where they're teaching somebody to fly a plane that'll never be flown, that will need a missile instead, in order to help Grandma or somebody in West Virginia, Tennessee that's not eating now.
Right.
The next between an installation and Grandma, eat for Grandma.
Yeah, that's very good, and of course.
So you could call it the politics of Grandma or the politics of potential, either way. I'll let this go on a little bit here so you can see how Johnson is seeing what he's doing as an extension of the New Deal.
That follows the theme on that Today show also, which used that kind of an illustration.
I never agreed that you had to prove you're liberal by showing how much money you could throw away. I have always supported WPA and PWA and river development and resource development and full utilization and public housing. Everything else.
Right.
I never supported corruption in any of those things. I never supported waste in any of them, and I never supported throwing away common sense and operating them. I believe in. I'm a kind of a half-breakage liberal.
Well, and of course, Paul Douglas has done a lot of work to make economy and government respectable. And
I just point out, Harold Hickey, Paul Douglas, some of the greatest liberals we got. Bucksmeyer, they don't believe throwing money away.
Yeah, right.
You don't know whether either one would like to be compared to the other or not, but
this is another theme in the Johnson conversation is just openly bragging and explaining, putting out his vita and saying, this is what I've done in the past and I'll continue to do it in the future. But let me push forward. And this is, Walter Heller was very good at metaphors and Johnson was very good. And by the way, they were pretty close. They developed a friendship early on in the Kennedy administration, and Heller was one of the few people in the Kennedy administration that Johnson had a pretty close relationship with, and so they cultivated each other throughout Johnson's vice presidency, and that's why he has such a warm relationship to push off here in the beginning. But this is Johnson out-metaphoring Walter Heller.
What it doesn't mean is we're going to have less money wasted and more money available for those things because of the stock in the
market. Right. Well, that's exactly something I want to stress. And
maybe people want, but that doesn't mean that you ought to turn on the hydrant and let the tank all run drunk before you put a bucket on it. What we're doing is we're gonna put a bucket under it and save all we can.
Right.
I could let this go on. He mentioned John Kenneth Galbraith. He's been bragging about Galbraith and things for several weeks, but somehow he conveniently forgets Galbraith's name. Johnson does in here and refers to him as one of the Harvard doctors. So it's another sort of, you know, Johnson way of saying, you know, Galbraith's a pretty smart guy and he's taller than I am. But I'm not going to remember his name right now. Johnson... and Heller have this relationship, and Heller goes out and helps sell things. Another quick little bit from Heller is right before Christmas, and they have this conversation where they're talking specifically about the budget. I just want to just throw this out there. I won't play the whole thing.
I want you to look at that and talk to Treasury. I'm going to have to get my estimates up here, and I don't want to be too low on my estimates on what we're going to do with these receipts if we get a tax bill.
Yeah, well, I think that
I'd rather be on the high side like every president has from Hoover. I'd rather say they're going to be 94 and have 93 than say they're 92 and have 93.
Right, agreed.
You talk to Treasury and see what your estimates look like, and I want this deficit just as low as I can, and my estimate is the news story. And I don't mind being a little optimistic. Hell, I'm an optimist by nature.
Well,
I don't want to be too much of an exaggerator, but I sure want to be optimistic, and I want to assume that things are going well, and I believe they are, and I believe business is pretty safe in this country, and labor too. And
let me just
ask you the State of the Union thing today.
Yes, they did.
I sure want you to get up
right.
Good, sharp, imaginative.
He's talking about a discussion to talk about the State of the Union address.
Now they tell me poverty's got to go out because y'all haven't got any good program.
Oh, now you got to hear us out on that.
I'm not going to do it unless you've got something that's got by Tom Girdlin.
We're going to
want something that stand up.
We're going to discuss it with Ted right now.
Well, what are you going to do? I don't want any of these boondoggles now.
Well. So Johnson doesn't want to boondock. Tom Girdler, this is a Johnson reference to a steel executive. He wants something that's going to satisfy conservatives. He's going to want something that satisfies corporate people because the political calculation collapses if you don't have that constituency. Not necessarily going out and saying, we love spending all of this money on poor folks. We love spending all of this money to encourage workers to organize, which if you look at what happens with the war on poverty, this is one of the things that actually happens. But he does want them to go out and say, not a bad idea. We're not going to oppose it. And this is what he gets from Harry Byrd, not Byrd coming out and saying, I support this tax cut and then I support the rest of it, but I'm going to stand down in my opposition to it. And if you take the roadblock away, the highway often goes much more smoothly. So the battles that Johnson's going to fight politically to get this budget down and then to get the tax bill through. Let me just lay out very quickly here what happens. So Johnson, in what he's really pushing for in this period that he's for grandma, there are three things that the war on poverty is going to represent and that these other things are going to help him get to. And that is, number one, he's for grandma. Always be for grandma. He's for growth, and he's for personal responsibility. He is for all of these things, making people into better people. Now, Johnson, in his attempt to help grandma, is going to cut out nuclear weapons that, you know, we're building all these nuclear weapons as we got them running out of our ears. He wants to keep building them, but he doesn't want to keep building all of them. He wants to be more selective about it. And so he wants to give that money to, in his words, grandma. He has a conversation with Walter Reuther, another Walter. And in that, you know, he says, we're taking it out of defense and we're giving it to people. And so Johnson is, you know, pulling in labor, and he's trying to make this argument in a big, broad way. Johnson is going to, in the budget battle, get support, not support, or reduce the opposition of Harry Byrd and others. And it's going to work. They're going to get this budget. So this is a big victory. And so Johnson has the roadway opened in this budget battle. And he's going to begin to push for this tax bill. And in a conversation that he has with Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy, he's worried about the tax bill gumming things up. He says if the tax bill delays civil rights, it would, quote, ruin us. And he said, I've got to pass taxes and civil rights or I quit. And so he shifts his attention to getting this tax cut bill through the Congress. And I'll just very quickly run through the things that happen here. He tells George Smathers from Florida that they had to get the damn thing finished up. They had to work all night if they had to because it was costing hundreds of men their jobs every minute you wait. He told Uncle Dick Russell, his kids called Dick Russell Uncle Dick, told him there was being unwise in his strategy to get the civil rights fight through. What would happen is that an excise bill, an amendment came up which was designed to cut excise taxes. And so all of these senators had these constituents in their home states. And this threatened to unravel the whole tax cut bill. And so Johnson got on the telephone and called members of the Senate Finance Committee to get them to not support this excise tax thing because that was going to throw the deficit out of whack. It was going to ruin his budget argument. A few strange things that happened. Harry Byrd calls in and says he's got a friend that he wants to be ambassador to Ireland, but he doesn't want to talk about it until after the tax cut bill stuff is through. So Raymond Guest becomes ambassador to Ireland in 1965 and stays until the end of the Johnson administration. New Mexico senator wants to have his supporter appointed to the Atomic Energy Commission. Strangely enough, Johnson offers it to him. An Indiana senator is upset because they make musical instruments. And this excise tax was going to really help them. Johnson says the goddamn band and musical instruments, they won't be talking about it next November. They'll be talking about whether, quote, we've got prosperity. Abraham Ribicoff from Connecticut was going to have to support these excise taxes. And Ribicoff said that he couldn't do it. Johnson talked him around, and he said, well, how am I going to save my face? And this is what Johnson said. Don't you worry about saving your face. Your face is in damn good shape. It's going to be better when I get with you. I'll save your face. And then the money quote, you save my face this afternoon, and I'll save your face tomorrow. Ribicoff went along, and the vote went 9-8, and the excise tax amendment was pushed out of committee and eventually goes through, and then Johnson signs the final bill in February. Johnson would tell Ribicoff, quote, I've had 56 days on this job. Again, this is humble bragging. And they've been the most miserable 56 I've ever had. He had actually been in office much longer than that, but you know, his math is what presidents do. So Johnson pushing for the $100 billion budget, the $11 billion tax cut to get the $1 billion in war on poverty is him as an example of the politics of potential, the gap between where we are and where we could be, and the war on poverty fits into this argument for potential, that this was the place where we can make better Americans, this is the place where we can make better workers, better consumers. And the programs of the Great Society in its initial formulation are primarily dedicated to do that, to make people more like the rest, to make poor people more like the rest of America. Now, what I will end with is something, and I have to complicate things as a historian. By the way, as a teaching graduate students, I refuse to let them use that word because they like to say, I'm going to complicate the narrative on the following. Well, I'm going to try to complicate that narrative before I take a seat. And this is Lyndon Johnson selling the war on poverty to a relatively conservative newspaper editor who grew up in Oklahoma that was Johnson's friend. He's going to summarize a little bit of what I've been talking about, but you can see how Johnson will use race and will use stereotypes to sell things to people who he's trying to get support from.
But I've got my State of the Union. I've got one that suits you. It won't suit you in Harrisburg in every respect, but it will in dollars. And Kennedy's going to have a 98.8 budget, and he's been adding $5 billion a year, and I guarantee you I didn't add $5 billion. And I may add a little, but not $5 billion. I got less employees than the Defense Department's had 15 years. I got less total employees this year than I had last year. Kennedy added 135,000, and I've added none. I just told Chief Civil Service that. And so far as prudence, frugality is concerned, you like it. You don't like my poverty. I'm going to try to teach these niggers that don't know anything how to work for themselves instead of just breeding. I'm going to try to teach these Mexicans who can't talk English to learn it so they can work for themselves. I'm going to try to build a road in eastern Kentucky, northern West Virginia, and a few of these places so they can get out and go to school, get off of our taxpayers' back, and so forth. And then I'm going to call poverty.
So what we see here is all the gaps that are leading, and Lyndon Johnson leads to maybe the most memorable gap, and that's the credibility gap of the 1960s. If you notice the date of this conversation, it's January 6th. January 8th is the State of the Union. After Johnson delivered that State of the Union, he got two, this is my last word, he got two what he considered compliments. One was from Barry Goldwater, who was a front runner in the Republican nominee race, who said that Johnson, in his speech, out Roosevelt to Roosevelt, out Kennedy to Kennedy, and even made Truman look like a piker. I had to look up piker, it means thief. And then probably the best compliment was from James Roe, FDR's advisor and friend, Johnson's friend from the New Deal, that said to someone, and the word got back to Johnson, of how are you going to beat that guy? He's Franklin Delano Hoover. So I'll leave it at that.